Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And with me today is Megan Church, the best-selling author of emotionally charged, empathy-inducing novels. And I can vouch for that, including The Girls We Sent Away and The Last Carolina Girl and the book we're talking about today, The Mad Wife. After receiving a BA in English from Indiana University, Megan built a career as a freelance writer. She helps authors tell their own stories through editing, coaching, and workshops. A Midwesterner by birth, she now lives in North Carolina with her high school sweetheart, three children, and a whole lot of pets. And for more information, you can visit meganchurch.com, and that's Megan, M-E-A-G-A-N. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Megan.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm delighted to be speaking with you.
So as an English major, I'm guessing you always knew you wanted to be a writer.
Yes, that is a very fair guess. Yes. I actually tell this story that I didn't realize at what early age I said I wanted to be a writer, but it was when I graduated from high school that my second grade teacher had saved worksheets that we'd filled out in her class, and she sent them to us as a graduation gift. And on one of those worksheets, I said that when I grew up, I wanted to be a writer. So it was something that I had in me at a very young age, even though a child of the 80s and 90s, I considered saving the dolphins and being a marine biologist. And
didn't they
like
all?
Didn't we all? Yes. I think Lisa Frank and, you know, those dolphin folders and everything had a part to play in that too. But yes, I always just had the urge to be a storyteller.
So how did you actually get into that career then? Because, you know, some people just say, okay, I'm going to go off, write a book and have immediate success. But that's not the case for most. So
it is not the case for most. That is very true. So for me, when I graduated college, I thought, hey, this is when I sit down and I write the great American novel and I am off with my life as a published author. But the thing is that I had a marriage and a mortgage and I needed a day job to pay those things, you know, like pesky bills that come in the mail every single month. And so I settled in at an advertising agency as a copywriter. But I kept working on my novel writing skills because as an undergrad, everything I did was short story. That's really all you have time to explore in an undergrad program. But it took basically 20 years of trial and error of writing two novels that will never see the light of day, but they were necessary practice in being able to learn the skill of character development and story structure in a way that I could write a book that somebody other than just my mother would want to read. And so the journey was longer than I expected, but it just took a lot of exploration. It took a lot of time. It took patience. I had three kids in there that, you know, were a little bit of distraction.
just a tad bit of distraction.
Yes, love them, but yes. And so it took time and it took persistence really, and just that continual drive to want to do this. And then it also took the right story idea where I could create something that would catch the eye of an agent and an editor and eventually a reader.
And what was that?
Yeah. So that story idea was my debut novel, The Last Carolina Girl. And up until that point, everything I had written was modern and contemporary. But this story idea was historical. And I put it off for a while because I didn't necessarily want to tell historical because I felt a heavy weight in making sure I got everything correct. When you write modern and contemporary, you innately know a lot of things like speech and verbiage and what fashion looks like and hairstyles and all of this kind of stuff. But when it comes to historical, there are so many little details that you need to account for. And if you don't get it right, your readers will let you know. And so I was very hesitant at first to go into historical, but the problem is I had the story idea that would not let go of me. And it was because of a personal connection I had that I discovered that a great aunt of mine had been sterilized by the state of Indiana when she was around 12 years old. And we, as a family, did not know this about her until she passed away at the age of 92. And so trying to make sense of how this had ever happened, how this practice had ever been legal within our country, I fell down a rabbit hole of research. And as I learned more about the practice of eugenics, then this character started to speak to me. And that became my first novel.
Wow. So I think you've already answered this question in a way, but I was going to ask, you know, you said you had two novels that you wrote before that will never see the light of day. Mm-hmm. Did you try to submit them, or did you know, or, you know, did you know that they weren't up to snuff?
Right. So with my first one, I knew very clearly from the last final period I put on that manuscript that it was not up to snuff. That one was an experiment that I did sort of on a whim. There's this thing called National Novel Writing Month.
Yes.
And it is the month of November when you can challenge yourself to basically silence the inner critic and just get 50,000 words done in 1 month. Okay. And that's still a short book, but it at least gets the idea down on paper and then you can edit from there. Well, their tagline is no plot, no problem. And I thought, this is me. I have no plot. So let's give this a try. But I discovered at the end of that month when I had my 50,000 words and I had my certificate of completion that no plot was a very, very big problem. And so I was too new to storytelling to even know how to fix the problem. But it was an exercise and I printed it. I put it in my desk drawer and it is not even worth revisions. But I had a second one that I worked on that I actually hired an editor and I worked with her and she taught me a lot about storytelling. And I did begin to query that novel. But the thing is, I knew it had a major flaw. And that flaw was that the main character was boring. And if the author feels that the main character is boring, then what reader is going to want to engage in that story? And so when the idea for The Last Carolina Girl came to me, I knew immediately that it had far more potential. And that was also what helped make me understand that this novel that I was currently querying was not going to be picked up and that I had better ideas to choose from. And so then I withdrew those queries.
Okay. Now, with The Last Carolina Girl, was it still a struggle to find an agent or did that come much easier?
It is never an easy process. Let's be realistic about this. No, it still took. I worked on that novel for a couple of years. I thankfully had a few trusted beta readers who gave me very honest feedback. And once I had taken the story as far as I could, I started the querying process. But I believe I was querying for, I think it was about a year and a half. I queried 56 agents. I did not hear anything back from the majority of those. I had a couple of full requests and I had two offers. One offer was the opportunity to revise and resubmit. Her vision for the book was that I would weave a modern day story in with a historical. And I did not like that idea because I felt the story belonged solely to the main character. But the other agent who made an offer of representation, she is still my agent today. She saw the heart of the story from the beginning and she has just been an amazing partner through this entire journey with me. But yes, it was a long process with a lot of silence and a lot of rejection.
So you're now on your third published novel.
Yes.
And are all three of them historical?
They are all three historical, yes. The first one started, it takes place in the 1930s. The second one, The Girls We Sent Away, that one takes place in the 1960s and has to do with maternity homes and the baby scoop era. And then the most recent, The Mad Wife, takes place in the 1950s. And all of them have started with this idea of a force in society that a woman is up against, whether that was forced sterilization and eugenics or the maternity homes or now hysteria. And really, once you get into publishing, your publisher does prefer if they can figure out how to market you, right? So when you stay within the same genre, it kind of makes their job a little bit easier. So these first three have been historical, but now I have my eye on something modern and contemporary. And so I'm starting to spread my wings a little bit and try something new.
Will it still have that theme of a woman kind of facing a societal blockade or
to a certain degree? So this work in progress that is not under contract, it's just been a fun exploration for me, is actually, I joke around that it is, are you there, God? It's me, menopause. And so it is exploring, especially perimenopause and that sort of sandwich generation that women a lot of times experience of, you know, caring for an elderly, aging ailing parents while also still raising angsty teenagers and kind of being caught in that middle stage of life. And it's looking at what a second coming of age could look like for this main character.
Oh, that sounds like something I would want to read.
Good, good. I will let my editor know that.
So, The Mad Wife. It's really a good time for this book.
It is. Yes.
And the reason I say that is because there's a certain segment of our population that seems to be idealizing the 50s housewife lifestyle. And hey, if that is what you want to live, more power to you.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But.
Yes, there's a very big but there. So a little background on me. I'm a farm girl. I grew up in a cornfield of Indiana. And I saw what, you know, housewives looked like, right? And so this whole move toward, you know, the trad wife trend has really had me stumped and puzzled, because let's just say that social media posts do not represent the reality of what housewives have experienced, right? And especially right. when we look at that post-war era of when some of these women were holding down jobs during the war. And when the men came home, they were moved out of those jobs and into the kitchen with now all the latest advancements in technology to make their lives easier. But really there was a lot of boredom. There was a lot of silencing. And the other thing is, we look at this era and call it traditional housewife, but that was actually a new thing.
And it was a very short period of time.
Exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, with all of my books in this historical look, what I say is when we take off the rose-colored glasses that we like to look back on history with, and we really take a close look at what actually happened, sometimes what we find shocks us, because I think we want to reminisce and we want to see those rose-colored memories, but we're not really exploring all the nuance that there was. And not to mention the people who were pushed to the edges, the margins of society as well. And so when I see these, you know, these trad wife movements and social media posts and stuff, I'm like, that is an alternative reality. It is not, and it has definitely not been what most generations of women have experienced within the history of humanity. So to idealize this and think we need to get back to this, well, let's really take a close examination of what that looked like for those who were housewives and really what their reality was.
Right. And some women thrived in that.
Sure.
You know,
yes.
It's not, yep. and that's great, but a lot did not. And,
yes.
You know, I know my own grandmother had a couple of nervous breakdowns.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's some tales that my mother tells of, you know, not basically not having being mothered very well, even though she adored her mother and and my grandmother was a great woman, but there were some times where she was a little absent from because she just couldn't take it.
Right.
And you know, this idea of all the, like the labor-saving devices and so forth, but the expectations increased dramatically.
Mm. Yes.
Of what, you know, your home was supposed to look like and what you were supposed to be doing. And for some people, that might be what they want to do, and that's great. But for most, it's not. I mean, again, with my grandmother, I remember her talking about this one period of time when she had a job.
Mm-hmm.
And she was working at this place that made tiny figurines like for train sets and you know, the big mm-hmm. dioramas. So they
yes.
made figurines for dioramas. And my grandmother was very artistic and mm-hmm. she loved that job. Mm-hmm. And I later found out that she only held it for a very short period of time because my grandfather didn't want her to work. And and it was probably the happiest time of her life.
Yes. Yeah, that is, it's so hard, you know, And during this time period, there was so much of a mask of perfection, right?
Yes.
And of fitting in, of doing the right thing, being the wife your husband wants you to be, and being the friend everybody expects you to be, being the perfect mother. All of these expectations just heaped onto women. And, you know, we still face our own expectations today, even, you know, if the household dynamic looks a little bit different, but we are still facing these dynamics and expectations and the masks that we're expected to wear.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about the main character of The Mad Wife and how she came to you.
Yes. So The Mad Wife, it is set in the 1950s in just suburban America, and it is following Lulu Mayfield. And Lulu seems like she should be living that post-war all-American dream life. She is keeping her husband happy, her household running. She is the talk of the neighborhood because of her Jell-O salads. But the problem is, you got to love the Jell-O salads.
I am laughing because, okay, I got married in 1976. So it's mm-hmm. a little bit after this, but mm-hmm. I think I sent in some Jell-O box tops to get
yes.
the Jell-O cookbook.
Yes.
And I was so proud of myself for these Jell-O salads that I made. And I think I still have that cookbook somewhere, but I have the only time that I have made Jell-O recently is when I had to have a what do they call it? Where you have to purge yourself because they're checking your colon.
Yes. Yes.
And mm-hmm. So I ate Jell-O because you can only mm-hmm. eat clear liquids.
Yes.
So
that's right. Yeah. Yeah. That was the last Jell-O.
Although I think there may still be a segment of society where Jell-O salads are still a thing.
They are still a thing here in the South. The most popular Jell-O salad seems to be, I forget the exact wording, but it's like a pretzel Jell-O salad where it's a red, I think it's strawberry Jell-O with strawberries. And then I think there's some sort of cream cheese layer and then a pretzel crust. And so this is still very popular, very well known. Shoot, even my kids, every like Thanksgiving and Easter, they like to do a layered Jell-O where it's rainbow colors. And so, you know, we go through setting each layer of Jell-O, nothing in it. There's no vegetables or no tuna, like what is discussed in the book. But they do every once in a while, they still like to have a little
bit of Jell-O. Still every few years will make the Jell-O salad where it's frozen strawberries and Cool Whip. And you blend them up, you kind of puree it and mm-hmm. with the Jell-O. So it's more like a mousse almost when you're done.
Right.
And I got to admit, I do like that.
It's not all bad,
no.
right? It is not all bad. But when they start putting things like shredded carrots and radishes and olives into Jell-O, that's too much for me. And that is the perfection salad that is the centerpiece of Lulu's table at her New Year's Eve party. And I thought that word perfection salad, it was just like, it was almost too easy to put that into the book. And it speaks so much to that era and that time period. And Lulu herself is repulsed by these salads because they're so artificial and it's so different than the organic farm life that she experienced as a child. But she makes these salads because it's her way of fitting into this new society that she's trying to be a part of. But she, you know, everything seems like it should be going well for her. But after the birth of her second child, she's just unhappy. And then she becomes fixated on this mysterious new neighbor who moves in across the street, because that new neighbor seems a little too perfect, a little too happy, because she always has a smile on her face. And Lulu doesn't trust it. She does not believe that smile. And she believes that a darker truth lurks beneath it. And so she begins digging to try to uncover what those secrets are. But the more she digs, the more she comes face to face with a reality that is almost too much for her to bear.
Right, right. And she, you know, she knows she's not happy. And she did with her first child, she suffered postpartum depression. Was that even really recognized? Then?
No, it was not very well diagnosed in that time period.
Yeah.
You know, baby blues or this or that. But yes, there was not really good diagnosis at that time period.
Yeah. But she thinks, you know, she feels very alone.
Mm-hmm.
Is she the only one who doesn't think this is, who doesn't fit the ideal, basically, who isn't loving it? And she kind of gets some hints from some of her friends mm-hmm. that maybe everything isn't rosy.
Right. So she has neighbor friends in the book. She has Nora, who is kind of like a Lucille Ball chain smoking, feisty neighbor friend of hers. And then there's Hattie, who is that woman who just is so nurturing. She loves her children so much. And then there's Bitsy, that mysterious neighbor with a smile who moves in. And, you know, they play cards together. And you would think that that would be a time to have honest conversations and things like that. But what Lulu always finds is that she can't quite be as honest as what she wants to be, that she wants to ask those questions if everybody else is feeling the same way that she is. But she still feels that she has to hide behind that mask. And let's be honest, none of them were living as perfectly as what they wanted their appearances to be, but they all felt that they still had to kind of fit that mold of that adoring wife and that loving mother who was just always so happy and content. But that's never always 100% the case.
And Lulu's also very young.
Yes. Yes, she is, because she got married young and had kids very quickly within what's the time frame. I think when the story starts, she's been married 5 or 6 years. I should know this. And her oldest is turning 4, and then she has her second child.
And she got married right out of college. So that makes her 27, something like that.
Right. Yeah. Because she didn't, her husband finished his degree, but she had not graduated yet when they got married.
Oh yeah. Just like my mom.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I didn't know until quite recently that my mother, they moved to the D.C. area. She was an Iowa native, and they moved to the D.C. area. My dad was originally from Pennsylvania. He was working at the Pentagon. And and she did go back to school. She only had 1 year to finish. And she did go at, I think, the American University in D.C. and it was a pretty, I can't remember which school it was. I didn't know that until just recently, and she's 90 years old now.
Wow.
I did not know she went back to school, but she got pregnant on her honeymoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so she didn't end up finishing until many years later. She did finish her degree after I was, after her kids were grown and became a school teacher.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep. So go mom.
That's right. Good for her for continuing on after all those years, That is still a compliment right there.
Yeah. Of course, part of it was my father died very young, very unexpectedly. Wow. And that's the other thing about the whole housewife thing is how many women are then left with no job skills and having to make a living.
That's right.
Yeah. Because of husbands dying or leaving or, you know.
Yes. Yep.
So
very true. Yes.
So one of the things that surprised me was when they got together to play cards, they would be in one of the houses, but they'd leave their kids sleeping.
They would. The 50s were a wild time, right?
This is really true to life. That really happened. Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Now, I mean, I can't say that
didn't
that
happen in my house, but
yes. So within the story, it says that they worked to get their kids on the same napping schedule, so then they could gather for, you know, a few hands of cards, just, you know, a few times a month or whatever, while the kids hopefully napped in their houses, and you know, they were right across the street from one another. But still, they would. And this is the thing about writing a book set in the 1950s, of that mentality that children should be seen but not heard. But honestly, in a lot of cases, they weren't even to be seen, right? They were to be well-behaved and in the background. And Mad Men and Betty Draper was a source of inspiration for this book as well. And just, you know, watching her mothering, that she would not win any sort of Mother of the Year award, that's for sure. But it really was a different era. It was a different mentality. I mean, certainly that was not how I parented in any way, shape, or form. But yeah, it was not unheard of for women to do that.
I mean, they didn't even have baby monitors like you do now. I mean, now you could do it maybe safely because you could keep an eye. You'd know when they woke up. You could run right back. But they didn't have that.
Right. Yes, wild times.
I know. Wow. What? How did you research this?
Yeah, research was really interesting on this one, a little bit different with my previous two, but honestly, each book kind of demands different things. And I really sort of follow that rabbit hole of where the research leads me. And, you know, some of it came from, I got inspiration from some different podcasts. There's a book, Unwell Women. Let me grab the book here because I want to make sure I get the subtitle right. So it is Unwell Women, Misdiagnosis and Myth in a Man-Made World. And it is by Eleanor Cleghorn. And she goes through a lot of the history of hysteria and misdiagnosis of women over time. And that was really essential reading for me. Also, The Bell Jar was in the journals of Sylvia Plath. Those were research in different ways because those were really inspiration for Lulu and her story and the themes and the tone of the book. But the strangest source of resource that or research that I could not have predicted was YouTube. I happened to, surprisingly enough. I early on in this process, when I first heard of hysteria and started digging into it, I quickly came across this video on YouTube of a woman in a therapy session, and I believe it's the 1960s. And it's this black and white grainy video of her. She's almost dressed like Laura Petrie from Dick Van Dyke, and she's smoking a cigarette, and she has her legs tightly crossed, and she's sitting on a couch, and she's speaking to her psychiatrist, and all of this is being filmed and it's just readily available for anybody to watch.
You're kidding.
Not kidding at all. HIPAA would not allow this of modern day therapy sessions, but apparently it does not apply to the 1960s. So I watched in this woman and the title of it says that it is a training video. Okay. So this woman is having this therapy session and she starts off by saying something to the effect of, she doesn't like it when it gets quiet. So she wants to keep talking or she wants her therapist to keep talking. And then she starts discussing how she had childhood trauma. It sounded like some sexual abuse had happened to her when she was a child. Then she starts talking about how she wants to divorce her husband, but then she brings it back to herself and she says, well, never mind. It's my fault. I just need to get my nerves in order. And the diagnosis given to her is hysteria. And as I watched this video, I think it's something like a 12-minute video. And as I watched it over and over, I was just putting myself into that woman and just trying to consider what she felt like she needed to say, how she felt when she was not being heard, especially was that moment when she pivoted back to herself, that all of this is her fault and she simply needs to get herself in order. And I just kept watching that. And that was really where this character Lulu started to evolve out of, because it was just trying to put myself in the shoes of that woman and think of what a woman like her must have been experiencing in that time frame. And again, not being her childhood trauma was not being addressed. Even, you know, why she wanted to divorce, what was going on with her within her marriage was not being questioned, because it was all being put back on her as she was the problem. She was the issue at hand because she was hysterical.
Wow. So hysteria has a long history.
Very long history, yes.
As a diagnosis for women who don't fit the mold, basically.
Yes. Yeah. It goes back to the ancient Greeks and Egyptians, where this was before autopsies, where they believed that if a woman was out of sorts, it was because her uterus was wandering around within her body. They called it the wandering womb syndrome. And of course, once autopsies came on the scene, they realized, oh, whoops, I guess organs can't just wander around inside somebody's body. But they felt that the cure and the solution was to coax the uterus back into right position. Now, this diagnosis of hysteria existed into the 1980s, and it became, in the 1980s, it was a psychological diagnosis, but in those ancient times, it was a physical diagnosis. Mm. But really what it was is it was a blanket. It was a catch-all diagnosis that could cover up a whole host of actual diseases and issues that needed to be addressed, like things like even rheumatoid arthritis or depression or anxiety, postpartum depression and psychosis and lupus and multiple sclerosis and so much more, because it was just, they couldn't figure out if a woman had complaints or if she seemed out of sorts and they couldn't figure out an actual cause for it, then she must simply be hysterical. So in the 1950s, the solutions to things like that were tranquilizers. We had the first mild tranquilizer, Milltown, come on the market that was heavily marketed. And then it could go to something like electroshock therapy, or it could even go as far as lobotomy and institutionalizing her.
Now, I understand, like with electroshock therapy, that it's sort of come back around to being used again. Mm-hmm. Is that true with lobotomies too?
No, to my knowledge, no, thankfully. So I did come across some modern use of electroshock therapy in my research. I didn't dig too heavily into that because I wasn't setting the story in today. But yes, there are. I actually, again, thanks to YouTube, I watch people share their stories of how electroshock therapy was the only thing that was able to help them and relieve their symptoms. And so from my understanding of it, it is a last ditch effort that they have tried therapy. They have tried different medications. They've tried a whole host of other things before they turn to electroshock therapy. And it is also done in a very different way than what it was in the 50s and the 60s. But lobotomy, no, to my knowledge, is not used anymore today, thankfully, because I mean, this lobotomy is the severing of the prefrontal cortex. And at first it was done through the side of the forehead is how they would go into the brain. But then Dr. Walter Freeman, he developed what they call the transorbital lobotomy that would actually go through the eye socket with an ice pick-like tool. Yes. Yes. Now, hold on. This gets even more wild. Like, this is astonishing. So he took this procedure on the road and he went into the state of Virginia in a state-sponsored initiative. And for 2 weeks, he drove around in a van that he called the Lobotomobile. And he lobotomized in 2 weeks out of his van 228 people. And they called this Operation Ice Pick. It's just astonishing. This happened, I believe the year was 1952. And lobotomy was always controversial, though, because while some could have success from the surgery and they would be more docile and complacent because the severing of the cortex basically dulled their emotions. So that's why they were then more complacent. But a high percentage had negative effects. They could be left speechless, incapacitated, unable to care for themselves. And there was a high percentage of death as well. I do not have that number in front of me, but way too high for this to be considered a safe operation. But unfortunately, it was practiced way too often. It's estimated that there were a recorded something like 40 to 50,000, and that's recorded lobotomies within the United States. Who knows how many actually happened off the books as well?
Well, what's really scary too is how many, I think it was used predominantly on women. Is
that yes.
And how yes. many of those women actually chose that for themselves as opposed to being forced into it? Same with the electroshock therapy.
Yes.
It's yes. not any different than back in the Bronte sisters' day, locking the mad wife right. in the attic.
That's right. Yes. Yes. And I mean, yeah, you know, some women did choose this for themselves because what other options did they really have in that time period? Right.
Yeah.
And so it is an astonishing history that, you know, I always say that I think we need to learn from our history. Mark Twain said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And so the more we can look back at this and be educated about what history was actually like, then the more we can prevent our present and our future from rhyming with these awful practices of the past.
Wow. Megan, why don't you read a little bit from The Mad Wife for us?
Yes, I would be happy to. I have chosen something somewhat out of the middle of the book. There are no spoilers in this. And it is chapter 11. And the reason I chose this specifically is because I think that it really gets you into the tone and the mood of the story and reveals some about Lulu and what her journey is. I turned off the faucet and stretched my body as much as I could in the tub, though it didn't give me the full space I wished it would. I couldn't lie out flat and float like I wanted to. I pushed my toes against one end, bent my knees, and slid my head down into the water. All sounds dampened, other than the crackle of the bubbles that floated beside my ears. The water swayed, swishing from my movements, submersing my cheeks, splashing up to my lips, even settling between them and into my mouth. I swallowed it, drinking in the soapy taste, longing for the purity it could bring me, partaking of it as if a communion. These are the bubbles pop for you. Do this in remembrance of cleanliness. What are you doing? Henry's voice broke through the bubbles in bathwater. I startled, sloshing the water so that it spilled over the edge and onto the carpet. Why did we ever think carpet belonged in the bathroom, the wettest room of the house? It merely acted as a sponge, trapping the dampness to grow mold as if a giant petri dish. Water splashed into my eyes. I reached for my towel to dry them, but it slipped from the side of the tub. My hand fumbled along the floor, attempting to find it, causing more water to cascade over the sides. Lulu, watch what you're doing. Well, if you can't tell, I can't watch anything right now. He held the towel to me, placing it in my hand so I could dry my face and finally look at him. He stood across the bathroom, leaning against the vanity. He had removed his work shirt, but remained in his tweed pants and undershirt. I looked at his arms, his stomach. Both used to be more defined, more rippled than they were now. He used to play basketball with the guys at school, help out on our farm on weekends sometimes, even rose some Saturday mornings as the fog swirled along the river. He hadn't done any of that since we had gotten married and moved to Greenwood. I sat in the tub, uncertain of what to do. I wanted to remain there, but I didn't know how long he would take, what he wanted to say, how much of an imposition he would be. I crossed my arms on the rim and rested my chin upon them, allowing the tub to shield my exposed breast, as if I needed to be modest in front of the only man who had ever seen me naked. We need to talk, he said. One night I dared to take a bath before cleaning up the kitchen, and here he was talking to me as if I were a child who didn't complete her chores. I'll get to the dishes as soon as I'm done here. I reached for the drain plug, realizing that my bath time had come to an end for that evening. Maybe I would take one in the night when I couldn't sleep. I had never done that before, always too afraid the running water would wake Henry. Maybe I should take one in the hall bathroom. Surely he wouldn't hear the faucet filling and draining, gurgling on its way down when I was done. Wait, he said, as my fingers came in contact with the chain. I stopped before I could open the drain. I think I know what's going on. He looked away from me, dropping his gaze to the pink carpet. Why was it pink? I hadn't chosen it. He pulled his fingers through his hair. He was looking more tired these days, and I didn't know why. He seemed to sleep soundly at night through everything else that went on in the house. Lately, you've seemed, I don't know how to say it, moody, distant, more than usual. He continued to lean on the vanity. I hadn't realized until then what a mess it was, so cluttered with all those perfume bottles, the decorative one Wesley had gotten me last Christmas, the one shaped like a cat. He had been so excited to give it to me Christmas morning. I dabbed some on my wrist and neck and spent the rest of the day with itchy eyes and a tickle in the back of my throat. I know, I began, ready to be chastised for being rude to the Butsters, but Henry held up his hand and I stopped. I think I know what's going on. I should have realized it sooner, but there's been a lot. He kept looking at the floor, and I wondered if he also thought the carpet was ugly. I assumed he did, but he never talked about it. But that's not what he meant. Standing with a river of pink carpeting between us, a bath mat that looked like an empty raft floating down the center with no passengers. How I wished I could be on that raft and float away from this conversation, this room, this house, and all of Greenwood. But Lulu, I stopped looking at the carpet and met his eyes, those brown eyes. I could get lost in them. Even after years of being together, they still pulled me in. I made a call. And we're going to have a dishwasher delivered in a few days. A what? A dishwasher. I should have seen it sooner. I mean, we debated installing one when we moved in. We should have. It'll make things easier for you. Henry crossed the carpeted river and knelt in front of me, placing his hand beneath the edge of my chin, encouraging it upward so our eyes met. And as much as they pulled me in, I still couldn't make sense of what he had just said. A dishwasher? Yes, I mean, At first, I thought you just needed some time and then you'd come around, but it has been a few weeks now and we've had those TV dinners each night. And the more I started thinking about it, the more I realized you don't want to have to clean all those dishes. So if we get a dishwasher, it'll make your job easier, right? A dishwasher would solve it all. That's what he thought. He looked at me. He looked through me. He wanted the solution to be so simple, a modern convenience that would snap me back to normal. I put my hand atop his and smiled, but what I wanted most was to fall down into the water, let it engulf me, let my skin and bones, hair and nails, soul and spirit swirl down that drain, let it gurgle me up and flush me out to sea, to be absorbed into a mass of water so much bigger than myself. That's so thoughtful of you, I said with a smile like Bitsy's plastered across my face. Henry kissed me on the forehead and stood up. Really? Absolutely. It was our word, the one I said to him when he asked me out on our first date, the one he'd repeated when he first said he loved me and I asked him if he meant it, the way I told him that I would marry him. I must have believed in absolutes then. That evening in the tub, as my husband looked at me and his eyes pleaded for me to let a dishwasher make everything okay, I thought about grace. Mama talked a lot about it. God's grace was why we were there, why the crops survived each year and harvest happened at all, why the war ended, why Georgie survived, why I got the scholarship and a husband. But for me, I think the greatest gift of grace was that we couldn't read each other's minds. Listen, he looked at that ugly pink carpet instead of at his own wife. Thursday night, we have a dinner for work. I know it's a lot for you right now, but I've already spoken to Hattie. She'll come over that evening, and I know it's been a while, but it would be a good reason for you to pamper yourself, get your hair done. While grace saved me from him knowing my thoughts, I wasn't sure I could hide the look on my face, the astonishment that he expected me to get dressed up to mingle when I needed to be home instead. I can't. I have nothing to wear. Go shopping. It's been ages since I've been to the salon. I'm sure they would love to see you again. And then with the most honesty I could muster, I said, it's too soon. He looked me square in the eyes, and I didn't want to look at him then. I didn't want to see the pity. What must he have thought of me? I sat in that cold water, the bubbles having long since popped so that an iridescent sheen swirled on the water's surface. It's time. And Lulu, I need this. He looked away from me, and for the first time in months, I saw him. The promotion wasn't coming as easily as he had expected, assumed, hoped. He had put in so many hours, worked so hard. He wanted this, and he needed his adoring wife by his side. She had been absent, but he was calling her back. Okay, I said, trying to get myself to believe what I had just told him. You're sure? I held his gaze, unblinking. He couldn't read my mind, thank God. So I looked at him with as much earnestness and compliance as I could. And I uttered one word, our word, absolutely.
And that was Megan Church reading from The Mad Wife. One of the things that I really thought you did very well in this book is you didn't make the husband a bad guy. You didn't make it his fault.
That's right.
Yeah. There's some other men who are maybe less good, but most of the men in the book are actually pretty decent men. Her father was a good man. Her
yes.
brother's a good man.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming this was a deliberate choice.
Yes, it was very, very deliberate because it would be easy to just make this man versus woman, but that's not the case. It's not the reality. And I have an amazing husband and father and brother and son, and I want the world to know that not all men are awful. So, but really all of us are nuanced and all of us are complicated. And, you know, even within the story and the world, while Henry does not always make every decision that we hope he will on behalf of his wife. We want him to see that she needs more than a dishwasher to help her through the shadow season that she's experiencing. But he is also a product of the era and the messaging he was hearing. And he was making the best decisions he thought he was capable of making at that moment within the story world. And it was just very purposeful for me to not make him the villain of the story, because I did want to explore a relationship that's simply complicated. It's not him versus her. It really is just this couple, you know, up against a difficult time in their marriage.
And he's doing the best he can.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
The other kind of issue that you that's more of a side issue, but I thought it interesting that you incorporate in the story is polio.
Yes.
And tell me a little bit about, well, tell the audience a little bit about how that features in the story and why you put that in.
Yes. Yes. So Lulu's family backstory is very essential to this character. And polio plays into her family that she does carry a bit of guilt because her brother contracted polio one day while she took him to the swimming hole, which she was told she should not do because polio was going around and they didn't know what was causing it, but they were told to avoid water. And one day she gives in and she takes him there and he contracts polio. And now he has lifelong consequences because of that. And it was just as I was exploring this character and what her backstory would be. And, you know, I knew that there had to be something that she felt this terrible guilt around, that perhaps she could have prevented it. But because of this one decision, because in a way, you know, each of my stories kind of also explores subtly, not at the forefront, but subtly sort of that butterfly effect of how, you know, small decisions can lead to consequences that we can't always foresee. And that was something Lulu experienced with polio. It was actually that particular disease was inspired by the fact that I know somebody who contracted polio here in North Carolina when she was young. It was actually before the epidemic happened. And her case was very rare. They couldn't figure out why she contracted it, but she has a lifelong limp because of it. And she was also telling me stories of she remembers when the vaccine was announced and just how elated everybody was and just what an amazing miracle of science this was, because this disease had just ravaged so many children, especially. And as she shared these stories with me, and I was just working on the book and that backstory, it just seemed like the right fit for that character.
I had a guest on Writer's Voices, not maybe last year, who was one of the last people who got polio before the vaccine. Wow. and had a leg issue,
yeah,
for whole life, yeah, because of it. And we talked about how sad it is now that people are turning against vaccines. And
right.
Do they not understand history? Do they not know what happened?
Right. I think we've gotten to a moment in time when we have had the advantage and the privilege of living post-vaccine, where we have not been faced with the consequences of some of these diseases for ourselves. And so we have forgotten.
Yeah.
And in talking with this woman, she's a close friend of mine, and just hearing her experience of what she faced firsthand. And again, like, she remembers very clearly, like, how excited everybody was, the parents lining their children up for this vaccine, because they knew what the consequences could be otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm trying to find who it was. I think it was Francine Falk Allen was the author that I spoke with. And so if anyone's interested, you can look at writersvoices.com and check out my interview with her, which was, I think, last December or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's, and I noticed that you have Lulu taking her son to get a shot.
That's right. Yes. And again, I was thinking of that friend of mine and how, what a good thing it was for the vaccine, and how, again, we make the best decisions we can with the information we have, right?
Right.
And especially after what her brother had endured, you know, there is a moment that she references when she takes her son Wesley to the doctor, and he is so scared of getting a shot, but she knows that it is for his good because she knows what happened to her brother, and she does not want to risk that same outcome for her child.
So, Megan, tell me a little bit about your writing process. Do you, you know, you mentioned how with your first book you didn't have a plot and you realized how important plot was. So now when you start a book, do you have the plot outlined before you start writing?
Oh, I so wish that I did. I def let's put it this way. On the scale of pantsing to plotting, I have moved more toward the center. But still, with me, it starts with an issue or a theme. And then as I really start digging into that, that's when a character comes to mind. But now I do better understand story structure. And so I do plot a bit more than what I initially did, but I still, even with this work in progress that I have, I was still, once that character was really speaking to me, I was itching to start writing the story, even though I didn't know all the plot points and all of that, but I needed to just get something down on paper. And then I go through revisions. I call my revisions basically layering, where I start with a very rough draft, and then I go back and I go one layer deeper, and then deeper and deeper. And the first few drafts are really that main character, and then I start exploring the secondary characters and making sure any historical elements are accurate, and making sure that it's hitting the right pacing and the right plot beats to keep the reader intrigued and compelled and turning pages. So for The Mad Wife, it was the closest to outlining that I had done, simply because of where I was in my publishing journey. That with my first two books, they were a two-book deal. And when those were both done, then I was ready to pitch what we call the option to my editor. They have first right of refusal on my next work of fiction. And so I needed to get that option package together. And for the package, all I needed was a synopsis in the first few chapters. And so I did not need to write the full complete book. And I had actually pitched two other ideas that they chose not to acquire. One was about downwinders who were affected by the atomic bomb testing in Los Alamos. And then the other was about a donut dolly who had served in Vietnam and was returning home and attempting to reacclimate and figure out what normal life looked like after an experience like that. And then Kristen Hanna went and released the women and all of that. And so my editor chose not to acquire either one of those ideas. But when I learned about Hysteria, then that sparked the Mad Wife, but it wasn't fully written. And so the synopsis that I wrote as part of that pitch package was the closest I had ever come to an outline. So then when I actually wrote the story itself, I had that guideline. It was not completely detailed, not everything was figured out yet, but I at least had that overall structure to guide me through the writing of it.
Did you know who all the side characters would be, or did some kind of show up by surprise?
Yeah, that's a good question. And not one I have been asked. So I'm thinking at the moment that I think most of the characters were there from the get-go. I knew all the neighbors. I knew Nora and Hattie, and of course, Bitsy were there. I think the one character that probably played a bigger role than originally intended was Gary, Bitsy's husband. His just sort of kind of kept expanding as each draft went on. But otherwise, for the most part, everybody was there from the beginning, including her parents, her in-laws, her brother, and the doctors that come into play within the story itself as well.
Now, she has kind of a problematic relationship with her mother. How does
Yes.
that influence the story?
Yes. So I would call her mother emotionally distant. And, it's not that her mother wasn't a good mom. It's just that she was not capable of being as emotionally available as what Lulu would have preferred. She had a very close relationship with her father, but her mother was just more distant. And she also feared, as we talked about her brother having polio, she also feared that some of that was because her mother blamed her for causing that. And so, and Lulu was also just, she's a different personality type from her mother. She always loved the outdoors and being outside. Now, her mother, whether she loved it or was trapped in it, was always inside taking care of the cooking and the cleaning and the kids and all of that. And they were just different from one another. But Lulu did not receive that sort of emotional connection that she really wanted from her mother. And then plus, having to care for her brother Georgie also meant that she wasn't able to be as physically present either, as much as Lulu really wanted her to be.
Is it actually true that polio was spread through swimming, or was she blaming herself for not a good reason?
Yeah, it was. Their contraction did happen at a relatively high rate around things like swimming pools and stuff like that. Now, I don't know the science behind that. I don't know if it was simply, if it was in some way, I can't remember at this point, if it did somehow cause the spread, or if it was more that those were gathering places of people that put them in closer contact with one another. But
Right.
yes, and it was, oh goodness, I believe it was John Updike who wrote, I'm pretty certain it was John Updike. Was it Updike? Oh goodness, who wrote a book having to do with a polio outbreak in the Northeast. And there is a swimming pool that plays a role. Then there's a summer camp with a lake where kids are all gathered together and stuff like that.
You know, when we were talking about hysteria and the history of hysteria, I saw a play years ago, that was about how women with who were diagnosed with hysteria, I think in the Victorian age, what the treatment was. Are you familiar
Yes,
with
I'm quite
that?
familiar. Yes.
So let's just say the doctors would use vibrators on these
Yes.
women,
Yes.
to cure their hysteria.
Yes, in fact, the story goes that the vibrator was created for this purpose. Because, okay, if we want to go a little a step deeper here, that before vibrators, the doctors were taking this
Manually.
spin, yes, manually. And so one doctor created this device, which became the vibrator, to help, yes, act as a cure for women. There's a movie with Maggie Gyllenhaal about this. I want to say maybe the name is Hysteria, but yes, it is a wild history.
It certainly is. It certainly is. Well, we're almost out of time, Megan. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Do you have any like final words of advice for someone who wants to write a novel?
Final words of advice for someone who wants to write a novel. What I always say, what I always go back to is perseverance and patience. My writing professor always said that publishing takes perseverance, but it also takes patience because it is a long process. And it's a long process of figuring out the craft, of figuring out your voice. And it also, there are no guarantees, in the world of publishing. And even if you have a story idea, you don't know if you can bring it to fruition. You don't know if it will ever become something someone else will want to read. There's no guarantee you'll get an agent or an editor or a publishing contract, or that if it gets published, that it's going to sell as well as you hope. And, right now I am on a wild ride with Lulu that, this became an instant New York Times bestselling book in USA Today. Day and it hit all the lists that it could, and it's still, 3 weeks out, we're still hitting those lists,
Yeah, Barnes
and
and
it is
Noble's
amazing.
Book of the Month, and
Exactly. Yes. And it has been wild, but I also am so grateful by this because I know the other side of it, and I know that this is not typical, and I
you're
know
not
that
an
this is not
overnight success.
eggs. No,
Until,
you are
in a
exactly
way,
right.
you are, because it kind of happens overnight, but you had 20 some years building up
Exactly.
to
Yes. So while readers may be discovering me for the first time, I have been working for decades to get to this point. And so it is patience and perseverance and practice. You just got to keep going one word after another, even if nobody else sees these words. The practice is necessary. Just like an athlete, right? You need that repetitive motion. You need that repetitive practice over time to really develop that skill.
Well, congratulations on the success of The Mad Wife, Megan. It was a very gripping read. And
Thank you.
I stayed up very late one night finishing it.
Yes, Lulu has been known to steal sleep from readers. So.
Our closing quote today, I'm using one from Gabrielle Burton. No one has a corner on depression, but housewives are working on
Oh, that is good. Perfect. Yes.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you so much.